Hi everyone, welcome to the Femina podcast where we chat about topics that need to be talked about more and topics that inspire empowerment. My name is Elise, I'm a co-founder of Femina & Co and your host for this episode. Make sure to follow us on Instagram at Femina & Co, check out our website at www.feminaandco.com and subscribe to our Patreon for exclusive content for the minimum price of a dollar at patreon.com/Femina & Co. You'll find all the links to everything I just mentioned in the description box for this episode. Also, if you want, follow the Femina podcast on Apple Podcasts and Spotify to keep up with our awesome content. And if you feel like it, give us a like on Spotify and rate us on iTunes. We would definitely appreciate that. Thank you so much for listening and enjoy this week's episode.
One, two, three, let's go!
Hi everyone, welcome to the Femina podcast. I'm here with Monica Cook, a sex therapist and educator, and we're going to talk about sex. Hi Monica.
Hi, so great to be here. I'm so excited.
Thank you. I'm very excited too. So let's just talk about you for a second and like your background and everything.
Yeah, sure. So right now I'm working as a sex therapist in two locations. I work at the Australian Centre for Sexual Health in St Leonard's in Sydney, and also a place in the Mona Vale called the Mindspace, and I'm loving that. In terms of like what got me into this space, I love science, but even more than I love science and doing science, I actually really love communicating it in a way that like helps and empowers people toward change, particularly healthy change. And I saw a really big gap between the fairly new and exciting area of sexual health and sexual health research and actually what was reaching the public, and there was not very much that was reaching the public ears. And I decided that I really wanted to be part of that process of bridging that gap, and particularly also breaking down the stigma of talking about sex by treating it like any other topic within health. And so that was really what kind of pushed me towards working in the area that I do.
Yeah, today. Getting rid of the taboo, like screening over and everything.
Yeah, that's right. And bringing some actual facts into that space rather than all the kind of hearsay and the myths and the things that get circulated over and over again.
Yeah, amazing. So, let's talk about psychology, the brain and sex. So what is the link between sex and the brain, and why is sexual health so important in terms of health and wellness?
Yeah, such a great question. And working in this area is fascinating because there are so many aspects that feed into sexual functioning, and the brain actually sits above it all. So you've kind of got the biological aspect, you've got the psychological and the social component. And I get to explore all of those facets with my clients, which is really fun, you know, as we explore all these different areas to try and figure out what's kind of underlying whatever their issue is. For instance, your brain can influence your biology through the release of neurotransmitters and hormones. It receives information from the body, and then it responds accordingly by modifying blood flow and modifying muscle tension and all those things. So it sits over the biology, but then it also influences the psychology. So the way you experience desire and arousal, and whether you recognize certain things as sexually relevant or not. And then it sort of, whether you move towards something or move away from something, sexual. And then you've got the limbic system, which is primarily responsible for all the emotions that you feel in the midst of that as well, which also play a part in sexual experience. And an orgasm itself can actually be seen and recorded in the brain as well. And then, of course, there's the way your brain interprets social situations and sociocultural cues and all that sort of thing. So, it's no wonder that people actually in my industry say that your biggest sex organ is actually your brain.
Yeah, totally.
So it's epic. And it's also makes up a lot of the work that I do as well with clients. There's a lot of work in the area of understanding the brain, working in mindfulness space. And it's also not surprising that mental health, so things like depression and anxiety, directly impact on sexual functioning, and vice versa, that like when you have issues with sexual functioning, that can also lead to feelings around depression and high anxiety and things like that. So those two, it really makes up a very big part of health and well-being.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, the brain sits over all of that. In relation to the second part of the question that you asked, like, you know, why is it an important part of health and wellness? Like, sex itself is awesome for the health, for your body. You want to hear all the things it's good for?
Yes. Oh my gosh, yes.
It's amazing. I don't think people realize this, but it lowers like blood pressure. It lowers cortisol levels, which is the stress hormone in the body.
Yeah.
Boosts immunity, reduces chances of cardiovascular disease, and particular kinds of cancer. It helps with pain relief. It improves sleep. It boosts libido. It improves bladder control, working out the pelvic floor, particularly for women.
Yeah.
It balances out hormone levels. It releases endorphins that aid in well-being. It burns calories, best ever. And it's also really important for relationships as well. And a lot of research also shows that having a good relationship also has a direct impact on your health. It relates to immunity. It relates even to your lifespan, how long you live. So a healthy sex life is fundamental to health and well-being.
And also when you talk about like healthy sex life, it's doesn't necessarily have to include another person.
Right, exactly. It doesn't have to. And it kind of entails like all aspects of what it means to be a sexual being, you know, and whether that includes someone else or whether that's how you feel within your own self and how you receive pleasure and how you sit in your body and experience even the pleasures around you.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're all sexual beings.
Yeah.
And it's a beautiful kind of thing to explore.
Yeah.
So, well, most of us are sexual beings. There are some. Yeah.
Well, people have a lot of unlearning to do, I think.
That's it.
When it comes to sex and sexual health and being sexually empowered in their own self rather than, like, you know, I think a lot of people grow up learning and education and everything that sex is only with one other person, like strictly one other person, like going beyond one other person is not okay. Being by yourself is not okay either, which can be very confusing.
Yeah, there are so many messages. There are mixed messages coming at us from all different corners. You know, you've got the entertainment industry and what Hollywood tells us good sex should look like. You have, you know, your culture, you have your family culture,
religion.
You have your friends, you have your religion. There are so many things that feed into, you know, that kind of can be very confusing if you haven't been given the space to really think through where your values lie in this, what you want to do, and be empowered with that information so you can make the decisions that you want to make in this space. We don't give people that opportunity to really think through that stuff.
Yeah, what a shame. Yeah.
Yeah.
Hopefully in the future. I feel like we're going in a positive pathway.
For sure.
So let's talk about orgasms in general. So women who can reliably orgasm through penetrative sex make up 25% of women. Let's talk about that. Is that true? What's happening?
Yeah, how amazing is that? It is. It is. These are amazing stats, and I just really want lots of women to know these stats.
Yeah.
And it's really important point to make that a little less than 25% of women can actually reliably climax through intercourse. And this is not necessarily because there's something wrong with them or even something wrong with him. You know, sometimes they think, oh, it's the lack of technique or it's the size of his penis. There are all these sort of ideas out there, but it's simply often because there isn't enough clitoral stimulation. And there's some evidence that that has to do with biological factors, like how far the clitoris is from the vagina, for instance. So if it's quite far away, there's going to be adequate stimulation to reach orgasm within the context of intercourse. So in actual fact, for these women, direct clitoral stimulation by her hands or even oral stimulation is going to be far more effective, and also not beating themselves up for feeling like they're broken or they're not doing what, quote, everybody else is doing.
Yeah.
Because they're actually in the majority if they're not orgasming in intercourse. And I think, you know, in heterosexual sex, there's a huge emphasis on intercourse to the point that those things, manual stimulation, oral stimulation, gets relegated to, quote, foreplay. And so a woman's pleasure actually gets overlooked in that space, and intercourse gets placed on a pedestal, which is so unhelpful in this.
It's kind of just like everything else is rushed through so that they can just get, it just can be that.
Yes.
5 minutes or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. And if they don't orgasm through that 5 minutes of intercourse, then they're kind of missing out. Mm. Or they go away thinking there's something wrong with them. I do also want to mention at this stage, I think even orgasm itself can be placed on a pedestal. People can think that's the be-all and end-all of an enjoyable sexual experience.
Yes.
And it becomes really goal-oriented, which is very unhelpful. And part of the reason why I see a lot of clients in this space is they go in with this real goal orientation. Must have orgasm. That is what it's all about. But just because a woman doesn't orgasm doesn't mean she may have had an amazing time actually, and be feeling quite sexually satisfied, and vice versa. You can also have women that do orgasm, but it wasn't that amazing or awesome for her, and it wasn't, you know, connecting or whatever it was that she was hoping for it to be. So I just want to kind of also be cautious about that too, is that it's not all about the orgasm. Mm. It's also about enjoying the journey.
Yeah,
within sex.
It's so important you say that as well, because I'm definitely in that time in my own life where orgasm is always the goal.
Yes.
Because I don't know definitely how like it's being placed around me and those type of things. But it's very, like, I think that's so interesting that, like, it's all about the journey and like you know, the like the psychological pleasure you get from it and, you know, the like everything else. And it's definitely something to talk about as well.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to say something else that I fully forgot.
No, in many ways, I mean, the orgasm is like the icing on the cake, in my opinion. It kind of, it's nice, but it's actually everything that comes before that. That is where the pleasure and the build-up and the anticipation and the joy is, actually. Mm-hmm. And when people get fixated on that goal of orgasm, they really, they miss the moment and they move towards an anxiety around, are they getting, how close are they to that point?
Yeah.
And that actually cuts straight across desire and arousal.
I also feel that, like, the more you stress and concentrate about it, it's not going to happen.
Yeah, exactly. It's like sleep, you know, if you're really stressing about sleep and you're not going to sleep, you've got insomnia.
Yeah.
It's so, you know, it actually cuts across the possibility of falling asleep at night because you're stressing about it so much. It's the same thing. You sometimes have to kind of take a step back and not focus on something to be able to make it happen or enjoy it happening on its own.
Let's talk about the orgasming in general in relationships and the gap between heterosexual sexual relations and we're talking about women, so lesbian relations.
Yeah, so the gap you're talking about is, I think, about 61% of women, heterosexual women, orgasm in sex compared to, say, 85 to even 86% of lesbian women in the sexual relationships orgasm.
Which
so there is a bit of a gap.
It's a gap, but it's not massive.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we're talking about orgasms in general, which is, you know,
yeah, it could be involve hands or mouth or
toys and whatever.
Toys or whatever.
Exactly.
It is. But it's still there, and I still think it's worth noting. And I think there are the obvious reasons why the gap exists. I mean, for lesbians, they're likely to be more aware of what it's like to be in a woman's body.
Mm-hmm.
They're more likely to know where the clit is and know how to touch it and what feels good. So there's not, you know. There's going to be that advantage, although every woman is different and still it takes time to be able to understand what turns them on and what feels good for that unique and individual person. I think also they're probably less bounded by sexual scripts that say that they have to have sex this way or that penetration has to play such a huge role.
Yeah, the narrative is kind of unknown, really. You never know what, like with heterosexual sex, it's usually, you know, like... Even when we were younger, it was always base one, base two, base three, base four.
Exactly.
And then it's like, it's always like, you know, foreplay this and that, and it's done.
Yeah, that's right. It's a very clear kind of way in which we're meant to move through sex.
Yeah.
With penetration being the be all and end all.
Yeah.
But I think for them, there's probably they're more willing to curiously discover what feels good for their partner without assuming
in the lesbian
relationship. So I think that's definitely an aspect of it. I think romance and emotion are more likely to feature as well.
Mm-hmm.
You see that even in lesbian porn, which is why some women actually find that more appealing than mainstream porn, because you see a lot more of that kind of context for sex rather than just like going straight at it.
Yeah,
and they probably have more realistic expectations around how quickly a woman might orgasm and keep at it. So they'll work with the foreplay. They might have longer sessions.
Yeah.
So there's a little bit more understanding of a woman's anatomy. And it also helps that women can actually have multiple orgasms. So it's not like when one partner is orgasmed, it's all over, as it is sometimes in a sexual context. The guy rolls over and goes to sleep.
Yeah.
But for them, they can keep going and they can have multiple orgasms.
Yeah.
So I think all of those kind of reasons combined might also mean that be part of the reason for that gap.
Mm. What's a way that we can kind of close that gap in heterosexual relationships to keep bring it up higher?
Yeah, and that's a great question. I think for guys, I would really encourage them to be curious about how your partner experiences pleasure. If she doesn't orgasm via intercourse, be experimental in how you can provide clitoral stimulation in other ways. There's a great website called OMG Yes. I'm not sure if you've heard of it. Mm-hmm. It's sort of...
We'll link it down below, definitely.
Yeah, that's right. And it's got, you know, just a whole lot of different ways in which you can... it's got women touching themselves. So it's not just for the men.
So it can show you.
It's, it's for women as well to know different techniques and different ways they can touch themselves that might feel good if they don't know where to start. Getting sort of starting with the grinding and the oral sex and getting good with your hands and slowing it down is a big thing. And asking for feedback, being open to asking for feedback, spending time with the context for sex, building romance, building connection, building anticipation, getting rid of that goal of orgasm. Because I think guys can sometimes really get quite, you know, that puts a lot of pressure on a woman.
Yeah.
They feel like the guy's waiting for them to orgasm. And so they're kind of thinking, what's wrong with me? I've got to get there. And there's a lot of kind of pressure of expectation, which then cuts across their capacity to move in that direction.
Yeah. What I've experienced a lot in my sexual journey through life is that when I would tell a male partner that I haven't orgasmed with another person, they take it on as a challenge.
Yeah.
And so it's like, and that kind of ruins it a little bit because you kind of I'm just thinking, good luck.
Yeah, but it's also, it indicates it's more about them than it is about you.
Yeah.
Right? So you're kind of feeling like, is this just because you're just doing this because you want to like put another notch in your belt?
Yeah.
But are you actually into, are you actually wanting to be with me and have this, share this experience with me, which is part of that context that I'm saying really helps women move towards the headspace they need to be in for sex? Is more contextual.
Yeah, I think also like when you talked about like the context of the relationship, the session that they're having, like the relationship and the romance, not every woman wants that. No. But also I think sex can be extremely, like it's all about like the mental when it comes to a lot of women because this is a side note, I don't know if this is correct, but I heard that like when women have sex, like the hormone that we're released is similar to the same hormone that is released when we're in quote unquote love, which is different for men.
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore like the mental game is obviously a lot stronger, a lot more important when it comes to sex.
Yeah, for sure. The way I like to frame it too is that when you think about it, men have their genitalia out there for everyone to see and for them to see. It's always been out there. They touch it on an everyday basis to go to the toilet.
Yeah.
There's a direct link between their arousal and what they see. Whereas women, it's all tucked away. We don't see when we're aroused, what's happening down there. There's no cue and like there is for boys. And so the visual cue of arousal and the things that guys get to enjoy, women don't. So they kind of learn to be more contextual around their sexual arousal. So they're more like, how am I feeling today? Or you know, how is he looking at me? Or is this a nice context
language.
Or the body language? There's so much more because they don't have that immediate like, I have an erection right now and that means that I must be turned on. It's sort of a more the environmental cues play a larger role for women than they do for men that are just sort of more able to see their arousal and move forward with that alone.
That is so interesting.
Yeah. So I think that's part of the mental game is, you know, part of what you were talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's a part of it.
Yeah, definitely. So when we're talking about like,
I was just going to say with the women. So I talked about what men can do.
Yeah.
But in terms of what women can do, I would really encourage them not to shy away from giving feedback, and talking about angles and movements that feel good. I think sometimes there can be a real shyness to kind of speak up for a fear that, you know, your partner might think they're not doing the right thing.
Yeah, and also there's definitely, like, stereotypically, there's usually a power.
A power dynamic.
There's a power dynamic there, and then there's this thing, and happens. It's common. It's not with everyone, but that men can, like, their masculinity is hurt if they are told what to do in a sexual experience that they should, quote unquote, should know what to do, but they don't.
And that's one of the biggest myths I work in this space is that if you were really connected, that you would just be able to mind read what the other person actually wants.
Yeah.
And it's so wrong because honestly, people's desires change from day to day. Like what I wanted yesterday may not be what I'm up for today.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're always having to check in with each other and sort of say, okay, what do you want it fast? You want it slow? Do you want it, you know, and women's bodies change at different times of the cycle even. The cervix is lower down in certain points and raised up at certain times. And so it can be more painful, more uncomfortable at certain times of the cycle. Post children, before children and after children, your body's going to change. What felt good before is not going to feel good anymore. So I think we need to get used to communicating more in this space without feeling like it's an impersonal affront that we didn't know. You know, because I think that's really unhelpful is to assume that you know what's working for your partner and secretly they're thinking, oh, gee, that actually is really uncomfortable, but I'll just kind of continue on with it. That kind of leads to long-term sort of drifting away of wanting to have sex with each other because it becomes unpleasant for both because they can also sense that their partner isn't into it. They don't know why, for instance. So, and I think that that's where it comes into play as well for women to really explore their body because I think a lot of women don't know what feels good. They don't know how to guide their partners. They know that that doesn't feel good, but they don't know what to say.
Yeah.
So spending a little bit of time in their bodies and understanding what turns them on and what feels good and what kind of touch they would like is really helpful then to be able to gently guide their partners in a positive way around their body. And I would also say, like, stay honest, like avoid faking the orgasm. I know it's very tempting.
It's the easy way out.
It's the easy way out. But it does lead to sort of long-term misunderstanding. I think a lot of the research does show that men actually report that their women have more orgasms than actually when the women are interviewed, you know? So there is that discrepancy there, which indicates that there is a little bit of dishonesty in that space. I just really encourage people to have those open conversations, those hard and open conversations.
So important. Yes, yeah. So sure. Obviously, like, this is all comes down to education, and education has a large role in creating sex positive environments.
Mm-hmm.
However, lacks in areas that are vital for, especially like growing youth in schools, talking about sex education. So things such as consent, I know is obviously being improved on, but consent, foreplay, pleasure, pleasure for vulva owners, sexuality and forming relationships, kinks, sex work, porn, and its link to unrealistic expectations and abuse. And those are just like a small list of things that I know sex education is missing or just gliding over. So what's your opinion on sex education now? Or like, how did you experience sex education when you were in school?
Oh, it was pretty much non-existent when I came through. Mm-hmm. And it was all about STIs and contraceptives. Yeah, look, I think this is a really complex area.
It is.
Because what people consider vital for growing youth actually differs in different circles, in different kind of, public versus private education, religious versus non-religious. There's so many different things around what people think youth need to know.
Mm-hmm.
In my opinion, I think things like understanding consent, being aware of and respecting sexual diversity, learning about sexual pleasure, and even skills around forming healthy relationships is fundamental.
Yeah.
As well as understanding how porn is purely entertainment, mm-hmm. not educational, and is really different to the real thing. Those are the things that I think are big areas.
Yeah.
My vision for school education in this space is for them, the role of the school is almost to provide a healthy and scientifically supported framework for understanding sex for the kids, whilst also providing, remember I was talking about before, a safe space for the students to actually think through and question and work through their own values and assumptions
yeah.
across the various topics, like bringing in what their parents believe, bringing in what the society is telling them, bringing in what they've experienced, all of those things, so that they can actually be prepared around, well, what do they, you know, believe? When do they want to have sex for the first time if they mm-hmm. haven't? And how are they going to negotiate and navigate consent if they're not ready? And what, you know, how do they know they're ready? What does that look like for them personally? What does sex mean to them as an individual? All of these things are so important for them to be able to have the safe space to think through these things.
Yeah.
What if they don't experience heterosexual feelings? They're actually discovering something else about themselves. Where is that safe space for people to be starting to think through where they might go with that?
Yeah.
You know? And so I actually think that part of the issue is that it's not just schools. It's not just the school's role to educate and equip young people, but I think parents have a huge role in this space. And, you know, in fact, the research actually showed that young people trust their parents first and foremost before the school education, before what they learn in porn, before the books that they're reading. They trust that source first, their yeah. parents, which is amazing given the kind of agitation that exists between, you know, youth, like, adolescents and their parents. Yeah,
and like sex, like the sex talk is always like, ooh.
Right, yeah. That's it. But they actually trust what they say
mm-hmm.
be over and above everything else. Which is huge. So my question is, how are we actually equipping parents to have these helpful conversations that destigmatize the topic? On, you know, how are we helping families to know how to foster sex positive environments within the family unit?
Yeah.
You know, how are we talking about sex to our children?
Mm-hmm.
I actually think that's another missing piece of the puzzle in the realm of education.
Yeah.
That I think I'm quite passionate about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For sure. I think also a big thing is also, like, you talked about the fundamentals there,
mm-hmm.
but then also knowing that these kids will not be shamed or, you know, judged for,
yeah.
like, allowing themselves to explore, because yeah. the realm of sex and sexual health is, like, so vast. Like, there's, you know, if, like, because you have things like porn is detrimental to a lot of things, but then mm-hmm. again, like, can be helpful in some areas, or, like, you know, mm-hmm. there's a difference between free and paid porn, obviously, and who's creating it.
Right, and, you know, that whole realm of ethical porn.
Yes,
know,
exactly.
Like, or, you know, are they, yeah, what are they accessing? Mm-hmm. What are they seeing? What messages are they giving? How do they define, you know, there's a lot of patriarchal porn, you know, like porn that really kind of devalues women's pleasure,
yeah.
devalues a woman's body,
100%.
And is very unhelpful to the male psyche, you know, mm-hmm. in terms of the kind of, but then you've got other things that, you know, if people seek out might be, my question is always, what are they seeking in that?
Yeah.
Are they seeking education because we're not doing a good job in the schools? Are they going to that because they feel like ill-equipped? And if they are, then are they looking at that and trying to model themselves on something that isn't realistic and trying to bring that into the bedroom with their partners?
Yeah,
and
I would missing definitely each other. Say that's
so,
sounds a lot like my experience.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
a lot of people I know.
Yes.
But then, yeah, so, and it's the same with, like, kink culture, and you have, like, BDSM, you have bondage, and, you know, like, it's, that's, like, a whole different, like, but it's yeah. part of sex, and, like, it's, like, yeah. shouldn't be shamed against,
yeah,
because
yeah.
obviously, like, the consent is present in the, and is very important in those yeah. communities, and so I think it's really important that these growing up, obviously at an appropriate age and when they're ready, like, I think it's important that these children know that it's not, well, youth, I mean, when I say children, youth are
mm-hmm.
they're not going to be judged judged for being curious about that
mm-hmm.
or like maybe. Yeah, what's your opinion on
yeah,
that?
Yeah, I would say, you know, for the kink community, even people with alternative orientations,
yeah,
porn in that space provides for them a space where they realize that they're not alone.
Yeah.
I think it like, plays a slightly different role for them where they realize, oh, there is a community. There is a space here online for me. Once again, it's still got all the unhelpful elements of like, this is what it should look like, or this mm-hmm. is the role of the dom and the sub, and, you know, kind of play, you know, maybe... Because the thing with porn is it's purely entertainment. It's an industry. It's a business. Yeah. They want you to go in, and they want you to keep going in and going in, and they make money from that.
Mm-hmm.
And everything that is sort of fabricated in that space is designed for that purpose. It's not designed necessarily for to help people with their discovery of themselves.
I mean, if it was like Netflix, then we'd all be, you know, detectives and superhumans and whatever. Like they don't have the same... purpose.
Yeah, that's right. I often say it's like watching, you know, Jackie Chan on TV and thinking that that's what you can go out and do. You know, like Jackie Chan is like purely entertainment. We watch it, we know that it's unlikely to be the real thing.
Mm-hmm.
But when we watch porn, it's the same thing, but we don't realize that it's completely unrealistic.
Yeah.
And the angles and the way in which she goes from zero pleasure to just like she's just there, you know, mm-hmm. within a matter of minutes, and you know, all of this stuff. There's no navigating of contraceptive choices in any of that porn. It's just, you know, hygiene aspects, like there's so much in there. So I, you know, have mixed feelings about especially these days, the kind of benefits versus the kind of negative aspect of porn. And I'm seeing probably more of the negative aspect in my field. Not to say that seeing it and watching it, people can't do, you know, to judge those, that thing. But I just feel like I see the outcome of
people
that have watched
a lot more detrimental to people's expectations.
That's
and
it.
You have like unhealthy porn, relationship, like a relationship to porn, which can, like destroy someone's mental health.
Or even move them away from real relationships.
Yeah.
And I think you see that's, you know, how you were saying there's a lot of unworking we have to do. Like we have to rework our beliefs.
Yeah.
And porn actually contributes to a certain kind of way of thinking, which I find myself having to unwork or undo mm-hmm. within my clinic.
Yeah.
And so I think that's probably why I have a slightly more kind of bias against porn sort of perspective, because I'm working so much with the outcome of the, you know,
the negative things that it does
that people have come in and said, like, I've got this issue and, you know, I've got these are my very rigid thinking. This is the way that I'm thinking. And it often comes down to what they've been watching and how much of it. But that's just my kind of angle. But of course, you know, I deal with very specific sort of population of people.
Yeah.
There are some people for whom it has no impact on. I don't see them in my clinic, right? So.
Yeah, of course. Well, talking about your clinic then, what's some advice you can give to those who may be intimidated by the thought of visiting a sexual health therapist?
Great question, because I think it does take a lot of courage to go see a sexologist like myself. And I, you know, it's, you're talking about things that are so personal, so private. But can I say, don't let intimidation be the final word, I think is what I'd like to say. Most of my clients walk in feeling like a high level of anxiety when they step in. But they walk out feeling lighter and relieved. Just being able to talk open and honestly to someone that will listen non-judgmentally and without any awkwardness at all. I mean, it's my bread and butter. I'm not at all awkward about talking about it. And also someone that's able to support them and be able to point them in the right direction. It's just like a breath of fresh air for them. I've got this great quote that I think is so great. It's by a self-help author called Karen Salmons-John. And she says, sometimes you just need to talk about something, not to get sympathy or help, but just to kill its power by allowing the truth of things to hit the air. And I think that that's so true. Like the minute the word is spoken, the minute the truth hits the air, the power of it kind of dissipates, the power mm-hmm. it has over that person.
Mm-hmm. The ice kind of breaks a little and it's like that little relief.
Yeah, that's it. They've talked about it. Often part of the reason the issue feels huge is because they hold it on their own. It's an undefined shape. They haven't put words to it. There's a lot of emotion in it. And when they start talking about it, they realize that there is a direction. It can start to feel manageable and like any other ordinary issue that you might face in life. Mm. I just think because it's particularly related to sex, it can kind of become a bigger than Ben-Hur when it's not.
Yeah.
It's just like any other issue that we might face. And the other thing I always like to say as well is I think that every person at some stage in their life will need sex counseling. Whether or not they seek it is a different thing. But like relationships change, bodies change, just like I was saying before, health circumstances change, medications change, you know. So you're actually in the normal category if you come and see me or if you see a sexologist.
Yeah.
Just make sure they've got the right qualifications yes. to be able to help you. But like that is a normal thing. And I think that, I really want to break down that stigma of like I'm seeing a sex therapist, there's something wrong with me. Oh, there's something right with you,
yeah.
actually.
Yeah.
You know, that you and 95% of people will probably need at some stage to see someone like myself to just get guidance.
Yeah.
To, you know, talk about stuff.
I think it's so empowering for someone to recognize that they need help.
Yeah.
Like that is a stronger thing than trying to hold it on your own.
Yes.
Like exactly. In any therapy at all.
Yeah.
It's always like recognizing you have, like you need help or you mm-hmm. need advice or maybe like you just curious, you want to
yeah.
learn more or something.
Yeah.
I think that is like very admirable in a way, but also just empowering.
Yeah, for sure. And that's it. And sometimes people come in and they realize they don't have an issue.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So,
yeah.
You know, all this stuff that they've been stressing about and worrying about, is this normal? Is my body meant to do this thing? You know, why can't I find anything like this on the internet? You know, why don't I look like that woman? Why does this sound happen? All of that, you know, when they come in and they hear actually there's a scientific reason for it or that's completely normal, that's just, you know, so empowering for them to go away and own their bodies and own their sex life and move forward knowing that there's nothing wrong with them.
Yeah.
And so sometimes I get clients like that too that have been worrying about stuff their whole life and I tell them actually there's nothing wrong.
Wow.
You know?
Yeah.
And for other clients it's a little more nuanced or there's more stuff that we have to work in, you know, the space of relationships or in the space of psychology or their rigid ideas or whether there actually is a mind-body disconnection there, like they're very much in their mind and not in their bodies. And sex is obviously very physical. So, you know, there's lots of other things that we can delve into. But, yeah, it's just being empowered with that information and being able to ask someone all those questions and know that you're heard and seen and understood is really part of my job too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Just vital for like well-being, I think.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
for sure.
I've made a list of some sex myths and truths and
yeah.
you've had a read of them, but I'm so excited for this because I want to go through them and I want to hear what they are, if they're a myth or a truth. So we're just going to
sure.
list through these and Monica is just going to debunk or explain or whatever. So let's go for it. So
sure.
we have number one, women can only orgasm vaginally.
All right, myth. I mean, orgasmic experiences can occur along different nerve pathways in the body,
mm-hmm.
actually. And you can, I mean, there are people that can orgasm from nipple stimulation alone or from working out really hard or even there are particular breathing exercises that can bring about an orgasm. But I always like to ask the question too of why a person might be asking about that, because what I find in my industry is people get really caught up in fretting about the fact that they're missing out on a certain type of orgasm, you know, like I only experience a clitoral orgasm but not a vaginal one, or I only experience a vaginal one, but not a squirting G-spot one.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, as if there's some sort of hierarchy of orgasms that exist.
Yeah.
But in the end, I really don't think it matters what kind of orgasm you're having, so long as you're enjoying that and you're kind of experiencing that pleasure with like an open acceptance and curiosity. You know, of course there are things that you can read and watch and you know, if you want to explore different sensations and experiences and learn more, but I just I would always ask the person like what their motivation for wondering about the kind of orgasm they're having is, and whether it's part of that is like, oh, I want, there's a bit of FOMO happening, like,
yeah,
I want that and I'm not, you know, and then it starts to become really goal oriented again, which
yes.
once again cuts across the purpose and, you know, the arousal
yeah.
and the desire that they're trying to experience. So, you know, there are fields like tantric sex and orgasmic yoga and things like that that are really interesting to delve into. You know, if people want to work with breathing and embodiment exercises and, you know, to experience different kinds of orgasmic sensations in their body. But I would certainly not, like, make it this massive mission. You know, I think sometimes your good enough sex is where it's at, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Amazing. All right, well, next one is kind of on the same line.
Mm-hmm.
So good, well, myth or truth. Good okay. sex is always spontaneous, noisy, and has to end in orgasm for both parties.
Oh, yeah.
And usually at the same time.
Okay.
Oh, wait, no, is that another?
Yeah. No,
did I write that on another one? No, let's make a part of that one
okay.
at the same time.
Well, myth. Easy. No, look, for many couples with kids particularly, sex can't be spontaneous, right? It has to be very much planned. But I always say this to my clients, it doesn't mean that a planned session can't have spontaneous and creative elements within it.
Yeah.
Or that it can't be, it also doesn't mean that it can't be planned by one partner and spontaneous for the other, if that makes sense.
Yes, yes.
And so a lot of people just go, what? Oh, yeah, I can know when it's happening, but my partner doesn't have to know, and it's spontaneous for them, and then
yeah,
they can switch
yeah,
it around.
Yeah.
And to be honest, a planned session also has its benefits. So, you know, you can build up sexual anticipation, sexual tension, prepare a little bit, stage your room, whatever you want to
yeah.
do. Foreplay can basically begin in the morning, you know,
mm-hmm.
sending text messages and build up the sexual energy ready for that evening.
Yeah.
So, or whatever it might be. So, spontaneity isn't everything. So, that's the first thing. As for noisy.
Yeah.
As for that, not everyone who is enjoying sex is loud and moany, you know?
Yeah.
Which
is, I think, is provided by the porn industry.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Because once again, they're trying to titillate, you know, they're trying to like feed all the five senses. But some people move into a really deep, like meditative state of ecstasy and they're very quiet, but they're really enjoying it. So I would encourage people not to guess or assume, you know, how I was saying people like should know what they're, you know, that people think they should know.
Yeah.
But I encourage people to not guess whether their partner's having a good time, but just ask them, you know, is this feeling good? How could I make this better? Watch for the nonverbal cues of what their body is doing, how they're moving, you know, other things other than sound. And the idea of ending in orgasm, mutual orgasm, I mean, if you can do it, go for it. I mean, it's fun, but it's also just as enjoyable to do it in any other way too, you know, taking it in turns. The woman might orgasm once, bring a male partner to orgasm, then come again. You know, there's lots of, I don't think we need to get caught up in a rigid, like we were talking at the beginning. Yeah, kind of this happens and this happens and this happens and we both climax at the same
narrative.
Time. People really do tend to get caught up in the shoulds
mm-hmm.
of like what sex is meant to look like. No one's watching. They get to create it how they want to.
Yeah.
And, you know, to be able to orgasm at the same time is challenging and also takes away often from just being and letting your body move.
Because then again, it's goal orientated.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And you're constantly like, is it now?
Yeah.
You know? So it's hard to do. So just go with it, you know?
Definitely.
Yeah.
All right. So next one, myth or truth.
Mm-hmm.
There are more than three sexual identities besides straight, gay, and bi.
Yeah. True. So like, in fact, if you wanted to get detailed, I think there's, you know, almost 40 plus, like
yeah.
46 or something, ways to describe sexual attraction, behavior, and orientation. You know, there's a lot of different words out there. And, you know, you have common ones like asexual, so people that don't experience the sexual attraction to others of any gender. Or you have pansexual, which is, you know, a person has a sexual, romantic, or emotional attraction for anyone. But then there are also less familiar labels like, you know, cupiosexual. So that's like a person who doesn't experience sexual attraction, more like an asexual, but still has the desire to participate in sexual activity or a sexual relationship. Or you have sapiosexual, which is my favorite, where the attraction is based on intelligence rather than gender.
Oh.
You know, so you have like all of these different like labels. But for me personally in my work, I am not a fan of labels. I don't like getting caught up in kind of boxing people in. I don't even do psychological labels. Like I don't slap them with a label of depression or anxiety. Yeah. You know, I don't do that because I like to simply ask the individual just to tell me about themselves.
Yeah.
Who are they? Like, how do they identify? Who are they attracted to? What is the behavior that they enjoy and want, you know, and just listen to how they describe themselves without making the assumptions or boxing them into any label. But I understand that, you know, knowing that that label exists also helps people find communities.
Yeah.
So they don't feel so alone in their experiences. So, you know, there is a space for it. I don't use the labels too often. Because also what one label means to one person might be different to another. Like I'm queer, two queer people might actually have completely different, like that looks different.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
So, I'm not a huge label person, but there's things you can go online and type in different types of sexuality and health line and just see what comes up and see whether, you know, people are wondering where they fit and where they lie. They can kind of explore that on their own and use the label if they want to, but I find it easier just to sort of, you know.
I totally agree with you on that part. But I do think a lot of people seek community, as you said, and also seek understanding of themselves if they kind of stray away from the normities.
Yes.
Which I think is very important to a lot of people.
Yeah.
Let's go on to the next one, which is girls don't masturbate.
Yeah, myth. You knew I was going to say that. That's an easy one for my field. So the Australian Study of Health and Relationships, it's done once a decade. I think it was done back in 2013. So we're probably due for a second one coming up. They found that like 72% of men masturbated and 42% of women had masturbated in the past year. So sorry, 72% and 40%. 42% had masturbated in the last year.
Yeah.
So that's like almost half of women. And men were actually more likely to have masturbated than women over the past 4 weeks of that survey and more frequently too. So men are definitely masturbating more, but women are still masturbating.
Mm-hmm.
The difference, it isn't surprising to me. I think, you know, as I was saying, for guys, they interact with their genitals on a daily basis. Unlike, you know, for women, there's that kind of everything tucked away sort of aspect to it. But I also... Yeah, I think a lot of women don't really know what they like or what they enjoy, and a lot of women actually don't touch themselves or even looked at themselves in the mirror to know what's down there.
Yeah.
So they tend not to kind of they can go their whole life actually without having to interact with their genitals. Like when men go to the toilet, they have to hold them at least. You know, whereas women, you go to the toilet, you might get some toilet paper wipe. You don't even have to come into contact with it.
Yeah.
If you got, you know, if you're menstruating, you just grab a pad, put it on your underwear and you don't have to touch it at all. It's just there, you know. So I think that might be part of the reason too, is for women not sort of doing it as much as men. But can I say that mindful masturbation is really actually a very healthy thing for women to do. It allows them to, like I was saying before, really listen to what their bodies are saying and be able, so they can guide their partners around their body. And also so that they can just enjoy themselves. They don't have to have a partner, like we were saying, you know, like they can feel confident in their skin and they can, enjoy themselves and just be in their body. And, I think it's even good for relieving stress and cramps. It's good for relaxation. It's good for boosting your mood. So there's a lot of like reasons why I think masturbation is healthy, particularly for women.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Let's go on to the next one, which is blue balls are a real medical condition.
I love this one. I think this is like half myth, half truth. If I might like kind of go with the middle ground. So, cause there are two ways that I find men talking about blue balls. There's, one, they haven't had sex in a long time. So they've got blue balls, which I think is just like a bit of a whingy way of complaining. You know, but then the second way that they use it is when they've been aroused but they haven't ejaculated and they're kind of left hanging, so to speak, and then they complain about having blue balls. Now, this second definition actually does have some basis in science, in that the kind of ache or the heaviness and discomfort that they might feel in their balls, their testicles after sexual arousal that doesn't end in orgasm can be real. And actually, because the blood builds up in the testicles, everything sort of gets flooded with blood, that can actually take a while to subside. And it can also give the testicles a faint blue colour, bluish tinge.
Right.
But the scientific name for it, I think, is epididymal hypertension. So there's a scientific name for it. But the balls don't turn bright blue and it's not dangerous. And it's also,
they don't fall off.
No. And there's no valid, it's not a valid reason to coerce someone into having sex with you either. No. Because you can masturbate, or you can basically do something else to distract yourself, like have a cold shower, which, you know, helps to restrict the blood vessels and help everything return back to normal.
Exercising?
Yeah, you could exercise for sure. Just get your mind off it, and it's going to be temporary. And if it's not, then go to your doctor. If you've got an ache in your testicles that's not going away, then that's something to kind of go get checked out. But otherwise, it's just going
to
go away.
That is so interesting. I wasn't expecting you to say yes and no, because in my mind it was no, of course it's not. Like, I mean, in a way it's not a detrimental medical condition, but it is a medical reaction, I guess.
Feeling it. They can feel that ache. Everything gets engorged with blood, and it can be a space of discomfort for guys.
I think I just deal with it.
We go through like monthly bleeds and have to give birth to children, right? They can handle it.
Exactly. Oh my gosh. Let's talk about the next one, which is celibacy means that you are a prude.
Yeah, so celibacy is a choice to not have sex.
Myth.
It's a choice not to have sex, and like any other choice, I think it doesn't necessarily indicate anything about the why behind the what. Like, it may have nothing to do with prudishness. The person might actually indeed be quite sex positive, but they may be religious, so they have values. There's a values-based choice to hold off.
Or they may be
having
asexual.
Sex temporarily or the long term. Yeah, or they're just asexual. They don't feel like it. I mean, slapping a label of prude on there is not only is it not helpful, but it might not be true at all.
Yeah.
It just might be a decision that person's made for themselves that fits who they are and how they want to live their life. Myth.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. So what about virginity is a social construct?
Yes. So myth. This is an interesting one. I'm gonna flesh this one out a little bit. So a virgin is quite simply someone who hasn't had sex.
Yeah.
So that exists, right? But it gets difficult to define when sex itself is difficult to define. So that's where the social construct component comes in, if that makes sense. So what exactly is sex? Is oral sex sex? What about anal sex? What about fondling and various forms of touch? What about intercourse without orgasm? It becomes quite an arbitrary definition. Mm-hmm. Like what is sex to have said that I haven't had it or I have had it? There are some societies, which I'm sure you're aware of, that use the hymen, you know, as an indicator, the covering across the vaginal entrance, as a test to see whether a woman is a virgin or not. But this is particularly fraught because a large percentage of women actually break their hymen even before they're sexually active.
Yeah.
You know, doing gymnastics, riding horses, you know, being active. And the hymen itself comes in many different forms. It's not like this sort of freshness seal that's broken when you have sex.
Yeah.
It actually is perforated in many different ways. I mean, it's got to let the menstrual blood come through.
Right.
So it can look like honeymoon. It can have two giant holes in the middle of it. There's many different ways in which a hymen can present.
Yeah.
And by the time, you know, we're sexually active these days, often there's only like a few sort of strands left of it.
Yeah.
So in some ways, I think virginity can only be defined by the person themselves. And that may well be open to interpretation because it depends on their definition. But I think the bigger question is, does it matter? And is it a helpful construct? Right.
Yes.
Which I think is really the question behind the question. And I think it comes down to how you use it, how you use that word. If the concept is for personal use, like as a way for people to understand themselves and as someone who is abstaining from sex and, until the right time, then that's their prerogative to use that word and identify themselves as such. But I think if the concept's taken by someone else and used by others to shame people for their choices.
In terms of purity culture and everything.
That's right. Or to put oneself in a self-righteous position over others because they are. It becomes a really unhelpful concept. And very kind of black and white and rigid and, really unhelpful. Like I actually work a lot with religiously conservative couples and in the church. And, you know, there are those that choose to remain virgins until they're married, and they can do that either out of love or out of fear. And I think, you know, doing it out of fear is really unhelpful. It really elevate sex to a much bigger issue than it actually is within the context of a relationship. It reduces people's worth and value down to what they've done rather than who they are. And it also cuts across the whole concept of grace, which is really important within the religious context as well. And people that tend to, I find that the clients that I get that tend to have lost their virginity before they're married, for instance, think that therefore everything in their marriage will go wrong because they messed up in that space, which is really unhelpful as well.
Yeah.
That somehow they're being punished for the poor decisions that they made, you know, in the past or whatever. So that's when it becomes unhelpful. That's when we have to do some of that rewinding and reworking.
Mm-hmm.
And is absolutely not what a lot of religions purport. They purport a level of grace and accept the fact that we're going to make decisions that may not be good for us and may be good for us. And that's part of what it means to be human. So that's how I work with those people in the religiously conservative realms.
And in terms of virginity for women and purity culture for women and how that, like, the patriarchy especially kind of puts the women's virginity on a pedestal, that it's something to be achieved, and then you have, you know, the labeling of slut or pure or whatever, how that can be really detrimental for women everywhere,
and in
a lot of religions, not just the you know, ones that we experience in Western society as well.
That's right, because it objectifies a woman and makes her worth and her value in just this part of her. You know, and it misses every other aspect of her.
Yeah.
You know, it really reduces her down to, is she a virgin or is she not, which is just, that's where the patriarchal kind of perspective comes in, you know. And it's really unhelpful approach and has a lot of unhelpful outcomes as well, which then flow on to their relationships and the flow on to the way they see themselves or they flow on to the way that they interact sexually in that space. So but like I said, there is an alternative. You can also make that decision out of love and own that and be empowered by the decision to want to wait. There's kind of the two sides of the coin. So
that is so interesting. And that's something that I find it a very important topic to discuss and find other people's perspectives and also just kind of analyze, because there's so many parts to it that, you know, just create this whole big thing that, like you said, like you brought to my attention that I, because I had been surrounded by, you know, its negative impacts, that I thought, well, some people are actually empowered by the word virgin and if it's your business, that's your business. If it empowers you. Yeah.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. I mean, but like you say, it does flow into all sorts of things, the way women dress and, you know, it could be a podcast on its own, right?
It could.
Talking about this.
It could be a series on its own.
Totally.
Yes. Yeah. So next one, let's go to men have a higher sex drive.
My answer to this is not always. Men do have high levels of testosterone circulating in their body, which makes them more likely to sort of experience spontaneous sex drive more than women. But every couple is different. And I work with my fair share of women that have the highest sex drive, you know, and that's part of the reason why they're coming in to see me is because, and can I just say that different, like mismatched libidos where one has the higher sex drive and one has the lower is completely normal.
Mm-hmm.
The chances of meeting somebody like a couple where they have exactly the same like libido or sex drive is so rare. right? It's always going to pan out to someone having a slightly higher and someone with a slightly lower.
Yeah.
And when I say always, I mean they might start out the same, but then give it a few years,
mm-hmm.
give life, give, you know, health issues, give things. And
yeah.
then eventually, you know, at some stage, it's probably going to look a little bit different between the two of them because they're two individual people. So I'm not particularly worried about higher and lower sex drives. It's
yeah.
like how you work with that and how both people's needs are met in that space.
Yeah. And what about the assumption of people assuming that those who do have a higher sex drive or are promiscuous with like more than one person or higher sex drive with
mm-hmm.
one particular person, they're judged for that and like potentially could be called like they don't have like
mm-hmm.
I don't know how to
yeah
how to
look there's
that,
judgment
but,
in every direction
yeah.
there are judgment on the women that are you know what are they what's the word when they have no sex drive like just having a mental blank, you know, the women that don't have any sex drive, they get judged. The
yeah.
women that do have high sex drive, they get judged. There's like no winning
mm.
here, you know. And that's why we just need to get rid of any kind of judgments made and just accept that people are different. They are turned on by different things. They have a different natural desire, like drive. And, you know, the people that have stronger sex drives and higher libidos, I think it's a gift is what I've seen in my work.
Wow. Okay.
Someone bringing the energy, the sexual energy into the relationship. If it weren't for them, they'd be struggling.
Yeah.
You know, that relationship is such a gift. It's, I like to use, you know, have you watched Frozen, Elsa?
I love Frozen.
Yeah. Like
best movie ever.
You know, it's like an Elsa superpower.
Mm-hmm.
In a sense that you can be really afraid of it and you can try and hide it. It can be this sort of big shame that you've got this problem.
Yeah.
Or it can be a superpower that you
yes.
own and it can create beauty in your life and in your relationship with
yeah.
that partner.
I think
and
I just discovered
partner,
the title of this episode. It would be like libido superpower or something like that.
Right. Exactly.
Love that.
Yeah, and you know, and as Anna, she slowly starts to accept that the beauty that can come with her sister's power and the fact that there's not fear that drives it, but love and an open acceptance of who she is. I think that that's just like people with a high sex drive.
Yeah.
They kind of have to come to that space of realizing, and it can hurt people too. You know, in the same way that Anna can hurt others, I mean, that Elsa can hurt others with her superpower, you know, left unchecked, people with a high sex drive can put undue pressure and shame on the person that doesn't want to have sex with them as regularly. So, you know, there's still stuff to be worked on in that space as well, just depending on what the dynamics are. But it can also be a beautiful, beautiful gift.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
I love that.
Mm-hmm.
All right, next one. We've
mm-hmm.
just got two more.
Yeah.
We've got women are harder to turn on.
Same as my answer above, not always.
Mm-hmm.
I think it would be more accurate to take gender out of the question and just say some people are harder to turn on than others. And, you know, that comes down to, like, if you consider your sex drive like a car and you've got certain brake, this is called the dual model control model in our field. You've got sort of brakes, so things that move you away from sex, and you've got accelerators, things that move you towards sex. Some people have particularly sensitive brakes, so there are lots of little things that turn them off sex, like the temperature or the baby crying in the other room. It just shuts their sex drive down. And then there are other people, and then they might also have really insensitive accelerators. So it's like it takes a lot to turn them on. Has to be good smell, it has to be beautiful space, they needed to have had a really good day, you know, and if you've got the combination of both of those things, really sensitive brakes with really insensitive accelerators, just, you know, biologically you're going to find yourself harder to be turned on. Not impossible, but it's just going to be slightly harder for you. So as a couple, you need to work with that difference. I think we also know less. I think we're talking about right at the beginning, even before this was all being recorded, the fact that a lot of science was male oriented. We don't know. There's not been a lot of research in women's pleasure. And I think therefore we know a lot less about women and female pleasure than we do about other topics. And that means that it feels like women are harder to turn on because we know less about our bodies. And it wasn't until just, you know, a few decades ago that we realized that the clitoris was more than just a little nub at the top of this huge structure, you know, that sits behind the vulva.
And then you still have the question about squirting, like, is it?
Yeah, is it real? Is it not? Is it G-spot? There's still juries out on that because no one's doing research. No one's being funded for this research, which is another thing. If you guys are in research, anyone listening, we need more people in this space. But, you know, and also we lead busy lives. Women need time to get warmed up. So, you know, your average woman takes about 20 minutes to be fully engorged, you know, for the genitalia to be fully engorged and ready for intercourse. That's average. So obviously there are women that can go faster and women that take longer. But how many couples are actually spending that time in foreplay?
Probably very little.
Yeah, very few. That's right. So, you know, and guys are looking at porn and seeing women go from zero to hero real fast and thinking, oh, that's normal. But, you know, no, we needing to take a bit more time to do things that feel good, you know, for her. And therefore they kind of get a bad rap. I think women get a bad rap. You just too much effort. You just take longer to turn on. But that's not entirely true. Like, how much do you know about what turns her on? How much time are you actually giving it? And, you know, those questions, how much research do we actually know about what we can do?
Yeah.
The three things we're not really touching on.
Second last truth or myth, kinks are only for perverted, damaged people.
Yeah. Myth. Not at all. My experience, like, everyone possesses a sort of erotic map. Which is a really unique way in which they're aroused.
Yeah.
And I think that comes from a combination of temperament, just who they are, but also their environment and upbringing. All of those things kind of combine together to create a really unique person and in the way that they're aroused and what they kind of move towards and what they move away from. You know, the question, are they damaged? Well, honestly, I think we're all damaged. This is my position. You know, no one leads a perfect life, has a perfect upbringing. That's part of the space and the relationships work that I do. Realizing that even if we think we had a great upbringing, there's still wounds that we all carry from past relationships and our childhood that we don't even realize we carry. We're all to some extent damaged, and we seek various different things within the safety of our relationships and our sex life, and that's completely okay. So I almost think that question is not applicable because we're all damaged and we all kind of use sex and relationships to sort of help us heal in various ways and help us kind of meet the wounds that we kind of had from whatever experiences we've had. But I think actually in the kink community, there's so much to appreciate in this space, and this is what I wanted to say, that that to the point that there's much that people outside of the kink community could actually learn from. For a start, there's a great sense of community and belonging with a lot of with very curious and open and non-judgmental attitudes, which we kind of lack in other realms.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
There's a lot of creativity and fun that's brought into sex, and I think we've lost the fun in mainstream sex, haven't we? Like, you're taking it so seriously. It's all about orgasms, what kind of orgasms we're having. But, you know, these guys are staging a scene and, you know, role-playing and using costumes and toys and, you know, it gets really exciting. And there's, you know, I think there's the other thing that I love about that community is that there is really clear communication and consent that's woven into the fabric of that, and also regular debriefing afterwards. Like, how was that for you?
Aftercare.
It's just, I feel like aftercare is something that's like needed in all contexts, you know, in the sense of debriefing and just having a talk about how was that for you? You know, how did you feel in that when I did that? Did that feel good? And navigating like really clear boundaries around yes and no and what's on the table and what's off the table. That has to be done in the, you know, kink scene, because there's so much stuff that can happen and, you know, there's all these different power dynamics and things. So it's really an important aspect of navigating that before they actually enter the scene or into, you know, do anything like that. Whereas we, you know, I feel like there's a lot to learn from that. So, you know, from the outside, obviously it can look really confronting, but I think when you step in to that space, there's it can almost be a therapeutic approach for people, you know, for them to step in and you know, if they find it hard to let go of, say, control in ordinary life, they can step in and, you know, if, yeah, they can find either, you know, they can take a dom role or a sub role and sort of experiment with the roles and who they are, and learn a lot about themselves in that space. So, yeah, I don't at all think it's about, it's only for a damaged, or like I said, I think we're all damaged, but I don't think it's perverted. I think it's just a sort of an expression of, self, which plays in a really important role for some people.
I love your explanation of that. That was just like so simple and like easy to understand for so many people who are probably really intimidated by that world.
Yeah.
And often judgmental as well, which thank you for that.
That's all right.
Let's go to our last one, which is foreplay only needs to last 5 minutes.
Yeah. Easy. Myth. I'm very heavy on the myth. No, like, you know, in my industry, they say that foreplay begins basically at the end of the last time you had sex.
Okay.
Yeah. So, as I was saying, the context for sex is so important. The things you say, the way you care for your partner, communicate to them, they all lay the groundwork for good and healthy sex moving forward. And sexual foreplay, you know, if you're talking about the traditional sense of it, not, you know, just everyday life, like it can last for hours. You know, if you have the time, and it, you know, the longer you spend in this space, the more aroused you tend to be and the better the orgasm. So to some extent, you know, within the tantric world, and I'm not a tantric practitioner, so I'm sorry to all those people out there that are and may listen to this and think that's wrong, but you know, I think they say that almost the orgasm is sort of indicates the end of it all, and the kind of bulk part of sex is actually all the stuff that happens beforehand.
Yeah.
So the foreplay is the sex. It's the emphasis. It's the connection and the energy levels and the eye gazing and all that stuff. That's where the meat is. Wow. And the kind of the end point is sort of almost, you know, like that icing on the cake, I guess. It's there, but it's not. So the foreplay is actually really important.
Yeah. Would you say in tantric therapy?
Or? Yeah, tantric kind of approaches to sex.
Yeah. Would you say that orgasm is... like orgasms are made a goal in that as well?
No, not at all.
No.
In fact, it's everything but.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's what I mean. It's sort of like the foreplay is the important part.
Yeah.
So if you're only spending 5 minutes in foreplay, they would probably say that's missing a lot of the point of sex.
Yeah.
So, you know, but I, like I said, I want to stay away from shoulds, you know, because I think it's really easy to listen even to something like this podcast and be like, oh, I should be doing this. I should be doing that, or oh, I knew this was all wrong.
They're all just suggestions.
Yeah, they're all suggestions. That, you know, the most important thing is accepting yourself and where you're at, enjoying the process, enjoying the journey, being open and curious about where it can take you, you know, and just having that, maintaining that sort of headspace.
Yeah.
And I think if you do that, you'll naturally move in the right direction. Whatever that might be, and come and see me if you need it.
Yeah, we'll link everything of Monica's put down below. Yeah. But thank you so much for coming on the podcast. That was so insightful and just really fun as well.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Check out the links below so you can follow us on Instagram, check out our website, and subscribe to our Patreon for more exclusive content. If you have some time, go rate us on iTunes and like us on Spotify. It really helps our rating and to draw in more listeners. Thank you so much for listening, guys, and see you next time.